So it was interesting last time to end on the idea of morphogenesis and morphic resonance and morphic fields. Even though we didn't go into that at all, still the idea was brought forward. And I had intended to start last week with Aristotle on these ideas, form, soul. So what I've done in the meantime is totally review this book of Sheldrake called The Presence of the Past. It's actually morphic resonance and the presence of the past, subtitle The Habits of Nature. And this is the second book that he wrote on this subject, and then he has written two or three books since then.
Just a new one came out a few months ago also, which he calls, I think, a new science.
The new science was written several years ago. Maybe there's a new edition of it. Mm-hmm. It was written in 86. Or 89, late 80s. This one was in the mid 80s, and The New Science of Life was written in the early 80s. Probably that's a new edition of that one. And then there's one in the, called The Rebirth of Nature, which was more recent. Anyway, Sheldrake is a scientist. He happens to have spent a number of years in Bede Griffith's ashram studying Vedanta. And so his scientific theory of morphic resonance is very much influenced by Vedanta. But nevertheless, it is a purely scientific theory. He begins this book, which is The Philosophy of Morphic Fields, otherwise known as Formative Causality. Throughout the book, he uses the term formative causality, formative causation. And the subtitle of the previous book, which is A New Science of Life, is Formative Causation. He begins this book with a couple of chapters on Aristotle, and at the end of the book, he makes the statement, in general terms, fields have inherited many of the properties traditionally ascribed to souls in the pre-mechanistic philosophies of nature, and the growth of field theories can be regarded as another of the ways in which nature has been coming back to life. What the mechanistic philosophy of the 17th century rejected, and the mechanistic philosophy rejected the earlier animistic philosophy of the Greeks, and what mechanism and what mechanists still reject is the idea that the world and all living beings within it are animate. In other words, that they are organized by non-material souls or animus or psuche, psyches, that all living beings are organized by non-material souls or animas. or psukhes. This ancient idea was worked out in systematic detail by Aristotle and by the Neoplatonists. So what we find in Sheldrake is almost everything that we have covered up until now. A complete theory of evolution, which refers often to the very same examples that we have been referring to. And I mentioned in an earlier lecture that what Sheldrake has tried to do is basically the same thing that we are trying to do in this course. And that is to understand the philosophy of evolution, or to create a philosophy of evolution. So that is what Sheldrake has been trying to do. And instead of starting with Sri Aurobindo, he has started with Aristotle. Now, this is the 20th lecture on the philosophy of evolution tonight. Finally, we have come to Aristotle, thanks to Sheldrake. We cannot do any philosophy without knowing Aristotle. It's impossible. So if we want to try to understand the philosophy of evolution, we must try to understand Aristotle. Definitely cannot understand Sheldrake and the concept of morphic fields and morphogenesis without understanding Aristotle. He spends several chapters introducing his theory by reviewing Aristotle. So some of the ideas that we get, that we will get from studying Aristotle, are such ideas as form and matter and their relationship. We ended last time by me saying that we would start to look at the relationship between matter and spirit. And we began with the question, what is the relationship between structure and form? So the relationship between structure and form is the relationship between matter and spirit. Now, what are we talking about? What does that mean? To ask the question, what is the relationship between structure and form? It is necessary to think about the meaning of these terms and this relationship in order to understand evolution. So tonight we're going to cover Aristotle's theory of that relationship in detail. And we might get to Sheldrake tonight, and we might not get to Sheldrake until next week. But it's very significant and important that we have come to this point through all of this time, and that we have come to it in this segment from the synthesis of yoga, from the idea of the citta, and that we have come to it also through Conrad Lorenz and the idea of habit, being the basis of species behaviors and species structures and every everything that we have said about diversification of structure in relation to the environment and cognition being part of the process of adaptation to the environment, cognition being the response to the environment which brings out in living things their structural adaptations. All of that comes from Darwinism. And it comes from Darwinism through Bergson and Lorenz to the ones that the biologists that we've studied recently. And the book that I was reviewing a little bit the last 2 weeks concerning the four dimensions of adaptation, of evolution, genetic, epigenetic, which means chemical, behavioral, and symbolic. That book, which is very new, very recent, contains in it all of the examples that Sheldrake uses in this book. And it's almost like they are trying to explain the relationship between behavior and genes, between the environment and structural change, in just the same way that Sheldrake is trying to explain those things in this book. But they are trying to avoid using his explanation. They're trying to explain the process of cognition, how the living organism adapts to the environment, transfers that behavior to its offspring, and in time the behavior patterns are genetically assimilated and the organism takes on structure and behavior spontaneously after having learned it through environmental change. They're trying to explain this phenomenon, which Darwin was trying to explain 150 years ago, and he came up with the concept of natural selection to explain how the phenotype, what we see and what happens in nature, is related to the genotype, which passes on those structures to the offspring. That's what Darwin was trying to explain. And that's what the science of evolution is still trying to explain. And the wonderful thing is that when we read Sheldrake's extensive effort to explain how this happens, and we read Jablonka and Lamb trying to explain it, and we read Dawkins trying to explain it, and Lorenz trying to explain it, and they're all trying to explain one thing. And in the end, with Sheldrake, we come to the conclusion, as we will, that what he means by morphogenesis and morphic resonance is consciousness. That's all he means by those terms. He's trying to explain how habits get formed and get passed on, how cognition works even at the cellular level. He's trying to explain how habits are formed, how learning takes place. That's what the biogeneticists are trying to explain. everyone can see that learning is taking place and adaptation is taking place, and forms are changing in response to changes in the environment, and speciation has been occurring for hundreds of millions of years as a result of these processes, and it still is not something that is understood. It is observed. It is deduced. The change happens, and it happens in response to the environment, and it results in better adaptation, and better adaptations, and higher levels of consciousness. And everyone agrees now, as Sri Aurobindo predicted that they would, that mind and life and matter cannot be separated. There's no question of their relationship. They are one process. But how does it work? It's still amazing. It's still a mystery how it actually works. So if we recall, later on we'll have an opportunity to recall Sri Aurobindo's definition of how the citta is a Vedantic term, and it means somehow memory and habit and response, and it's that underlying coherence and continuity in behavior that makes behavior conscious. It is the subconscious level of consciousness, so that all of nature works in a conscious way. And we inherited that level from all the previous epochs of evolution. And then there is the sense mind. And Sri Aurobindo describes manas. Mr. Sheldrake describes manas. Sight, sound, touch, taste give us information. Give every organism information about the environment and about themselves. So Sheldrake decided to try to explain how information could possibly be explained, how information transfer and habit and recurrence of patterns and gradual evolution of forms could possibly be explained, which is exactly what Jablonka and Dawkins and Darwin and all of these scientifically inclined philosophers of evolution have tried in the last 150 years, how to explain conscious evolution. So Aristotle started doing this 2,400 years ago, and what he wrote hasn't been significantly bettered by anyone. Now, it's very important to learn something about Aristotle's thinking, because it is our way of thinking. We have inherited patterns of thinking from the Greeks, and they have inherited those patterns of thinking from hundreds of millions of years of evolution, and nobody thinks very much differently. It is the paradigm of thinking. So if we understand the basic form of thinking and understanding and what we call the buddhi, the mental consciousness, then we will know what we have to leave behind. The evolution, the evolution, now concentrate on this for a moment. What do we mean by the evolution of consciousness? What does Sri Aurobindo mean when he says that we need to move into the higher hemisphere where it's no more thinking, it's thought itself, it's energy itself. It is another power of consciousness that wants to evolve. We have to know what it is that is evolving, mind, and we have to try to discover what it is that wants to evolve, supermind. And we have to come to terms with the hard reality that one must displace the other. And as long as we continue the patterns that have evolved up until now, that new pattern cannot come into play. It's all play, anyway. But we began this course, this series, with the psychological standpoint that Sri Aurobindo describes of how mind evolved and to what levels it shall evolve if certain conditions are met. And he has given us a key concept for understanding the difference between the way the higher hemisphere works and the way the lower hemisphere works. But my feeling is that we can't comprehend that concept very easily, that key concept, because we are completely stuck in the lower hemisphere evolution. Habit. The habit which has evolved for about 400 million years prevents us from making that transition into the higher hemisphere. Even though Sri Aurobindo has given us very specific instructions and a clear key, conceptual key to that change, the fact is that we are stuck in what all of these biologists and philosophers of biology have identified very precisely as habits of mind. The habits of the mental being. They are us. We are them. That is it. And we understand the whole world and all of our responses to that world are based upon the way we understand the whole world in terms of these dualities. Form and matter. And the last thing I said last time was that the scientists, wonderful people, brilliant, beautiful, free, clear thinking, dedicated, hard-working people spend all of their energy trying to define the structures and processes of the material world, and the philosophers, also beautiful, powerful, hard-working, clear-headed, free-thinking, persistent, immortal beings that they are, spend all of their time and energy trying to define the structures of form, the meaning of form. And there are a few oddballs among us who dabble in both. But the transformation that has been projected by Sri Aurobindo is a spiritualization of matter, where form and matter, consciousness and force, are felt, seen, lived, embodied as one thing, one essential being, not separated and related and mental, but powerfully, manifestly, supramental. And that means that all of this effort of the last 2,400 years to understand the relationship between form and matter will finally be understood. But until then, it will not be understood. And when we get to the end of Aristotle, and when we get to the end of Sheldrake, the most important thing for us to realize is that it hasn't been understood. Sheldrake has not understood. And in fact, he has gone down a path which prevents understanding. But it's a very interesting path.
Maybe I have a question at this point. But you also said that the philosopher and all the researcher studied and realized all their things. They are, I say, experienced immortality, luminosity. Because when you go on this map, on this level, it's very luminous. It's very full of light, yeah, and it's very light. And if you go in, this is also a substance. So for me, is that the question, and also in Sakuti or other ones, is there also that the mind very high can go to this, it's one path, the more secure path is maybe to the psychic, but this is also one path. So, it is more difficult than the law, or it must be more easier when the immortality is felt by the people and it is there, and when you...
That's an amazing question.
Yeah.
So, my theory, much simpler than Sheldrake's, my theory is that we can acquire certain tools for accomplishing that higher energy field that transforms our ordinary way of understanding things. We can acquire those tools. Whether we use them or not, whether the scientist uses them or not, whether the philosopher uses them or not, is an individual matter. But I'm convinced that there are tools that can liberate us into energy fields that we have not normally experienced. But it's a process, it's a philosophical process of gathering the tools, allowing them to form understanding in us, and transition us into that other, more direct way of knowing. And that's the key. There is another way of knowing nature, which is not this way. But we must understand what this way is in order to find that other way. That's my theory.
Yeah.
I don't think any knowledge comes with Ananda except knowledge of Ananda. So that's the, you know, the Vedic approach is very good for that. But there's another approach that Sri Aurobindo is recommending. It's not the scientific approach, and it's not the philosophical approach, and it's not the Vedic approach. It's something else. And people don't want to admit the fact that it is something else. And so they jump for this one, and they jump for that one, and they jump for that one, and we're like fleas jumping on the back of the dog, you know, just jumping all the time, having a great time jumping. So I want us to take the time to work through the paradigm of understanding that is ours. And then I want us to work through the paradigm of understanding that Sheldrake suggests. And eventually I want us to get back to Sri Aurobindo's Vedantic understanding. And when we have all those tools in our toolkit, then what I've been asking us to do for the last few weeks, and that is to simply suspend judgments, opinions, dogmas, impressions, and generate an energy of being nature. Whether you think about nature as Agni, as energy and cognition, as divine force, as the descent and eternal efflorescence of Mahalakshmi in matter, or the ongoing adaptation and variation of structure, however you take it, if you can stop thinking about those theories and engage your consciousness in an impersonal, universal perception of what nature is itself. Being is what the best philosophers call it. If we can make that transition from all of these well-honed conceptual forms and away from all of these preoccupations with the nitty-gritty mechanics of things, and perceive nature directly as herself, without mediating nature by concepts. You see, this is something that philosophers have learned in the last 100 years that's very important. The phenomenologists and the critical thinkers have learned this, and they've told us, but what does it mean to us? We're just stuck in the old pattern, so it doesn't mean anything to us. But some people have figured out that unmediated consciousness is possible. Consciousness which is not mediated, consciousness of reality inside and out, not mediated by concepts, not mediated by theories, not mediated by methodologies, just being itself, physical, vital, mental, spiritual being. No mythological elevation of the possible meaning of being. No analytical explanation of the actual meaning of being. Being itself. Fully energized, conscious being. That's where we want to go. It helps to be aware of where we are now, so that we'll know that when we go somewhere else, it's really significantly different, and we're not just pretending from where we are now that we are somewhere else. So I want to have the opportunity to bore you with Aristotle for a while, and don't try to figure out what the words mean. Okay? I will tell you what they mean. Because the language of Aristotle is Greek, and this is an English 19th century translation of Aristotle, and it's not Aristotle. But we can use it as a kind of hook. So I will read to you what it says, and then I will tell you what it means. And you sort of, in a detached way, observe what it says, and observe what I say that it means, and don't be attached to either one of those things. Just allow. It's, you know, it's like a painting. You know, for we'll paint the strokes, and then we'll paint over them another layer of strokes, and then you will have some picture in the end of what it all means, which you'll digest over some time, period of time, and you'll begin to understand what it means. But right now, you don't need to understand what it means. Just listen to what it says. And little by little, you will appreciate the fact that it, what it means is exactly the way you see things all the time. Aristotle is so clever. He's the greatest mind that ever walked the earth. There's no doubt about it. And so he took all of these wonderful, this wonderful cosmic understanding of Plato, and integrated it into the way things are. You know, Plato's vision is true, but it's all anecdotal and parabolic. And so Aristotle translates it into the way it is. And then we will see that that's the way it is. So what is soul? We're in the habit of recognizing. Look at those two wonderful words, habit and recognize. That's the whole thing right there. Nothing is except by habit. We know that now from studying evolution, right? The mother agrees. She says the same thing in the agenda. Even death is a bad habit. We are in the habit of recognizing as one determinate kind of what is substance. And that in several senses. A, in the sense of matter, or that which in itself is not a this. So if we think of the quantum field and we think of physics and the movement of vectors and the constants, the universal constants, and all of those things, they are not a dog or a giraffe. They are fields of force. Hule, Aristotle called it, the heap, the stuff. So we're in the habit of thinking about the nice yellow jacket and chuni. We're not thinking about the molecules of silk and the molecules of carbohydrates that make up the nice wearable cloth. So, D, we're in the habit of recognizing as another determinate kind of what is the sense of form or essence, which is that precisely in virtue of which a thing is called a this. And thirdly, in the sense of that which is compounded of both A and B. So, these nice clothes that we wear are obviously compounded of both A and B, substance and form. But what we normally think of is the form. We don't normally think of the substance, unless we happen to be obsessed scientists. So similarly, with evolution, we normally think of species. We don't even think of their behaviors, necessarily. We just think of what they are. Human beings. Shrews. Microorganisms. Now, here's a very important distinction. Matter is potentiality, form, actuality. So the carbohydrates in the cotton buds, or the electrons in the UPS system, are potentially clothing and light. But when they get to be clothing and light, they are actually something. Matter is potentiality, form actuality. Of the latter, there are two grades related to one another, as, for example, knowledge to the exercise of knowledge. So when you are healing someone, you are actually a healer. But when you are not healing someone, you are potentially a healer. But you're still a healer in both cases. Among some, or a linguist, let's don't leave anyone out here, or a musician. You're a musician whether you're playing or not. But when you're not playing, you are potentially a musician. Among substances, are by general consent reckoned bodies, and especially natural bodies, like molecules and organs and organisms, for they are the principles of all other bodies. Of natural bodies, some have life in them, others not. By life we mean self-nutrition and growth. So remember the definition last time, the current definition, that life is one, dissipative energy fields which maintain the coherence of the thing, autopoiesis, self-reproducing behavior, which means eating and digesting and converting energy into purpose, including reproduction of the type. And that reproduction of the type happens every minute, as well as through procreation. We are creating ourselves all the time. And the third one, the third principle, cognition. In that process of energy exchange and self-creation, there is an understanding of the self and the environment and the whole dynamics of living. Every field of life is a field of cognition, as well as nutrition and reproduction and dissipation of energy fields. Right? Everybody agree? Physical, vital, mental, all one complex at every level. Some more complicated and complex than others. In the morphic resonance theory, this is called a holarchy. A holarchy, H-O-L-A-R-C-H-Y, holarchy, and a hierarchy of forms contained within forms. We're jumping ahead to Sheldrake now. There are the molecules, there are the organs, there is the organism, there is the relationship of the organism to the biosphere, there's the relationship of the biosphere to the cosmos. Holons embedded within holons. The holarchy of forms that make us up, make up the organism, make up the society, make up the field. But since it is also a body of such and such kind, having life, not having life, the body cannot be soul. The body is the subject or matter, not what is attributed to it. Hence, the soul must be a substance in the sense of the form of a natural body having life potentially within it. But substance is actuality, and thus soul is the actuality of a body as above characterized. Now, the word actuality has two senses corresponding respectively to the possession of knowledge and the actual exercise of knowledge. That's a metaphorical comparison. It is obvious that the soul is actuality in the first sense, that of knowledge as possessed. For both sleeping and waking presuppose the existence of soul, and of these, waking corresponds to actual knowing, sleeping to knowledge possessed but not employed, potential. And in the history of the individual, knowledge comes before its employment or exercise. You must know music before you play it. But not playing it, being asleep, doesn't mean that you don't know it. It's still there. It's your soul. It's your being. Your being has formed itself into a conscious, acting human. Even when you're asleep and nobody sees you, you're still potentially a conscious, acting human, as every two-year-old realizes. Maybe three. That is why the soul is the first grade of actuality of a natural body having life potentially in it. The body so described is a body which is organized. The parts of plants, in spite of their extreme simplicity, are organs. The leaf serves to shelter the pericarp to shelter the fruit, while the roots of plants are analogous to the mouth of animals, both serving for the absorption of food. If then we have to give a general formula applicable to all kinds of soul, we must describe it as the first grade of actuality of a natural organized body. That is why we can wholly dismiss as unnecessary the question whether the soul and the body are one. It is as meaningless as to ask whether the wax and the shape given to it by the stamp are one. Or generally, the matter of a thing and that of which it is the matter. Unity has many senses, as many as is. Has. Now, let's think about this most profound philosophical concept, is, to be a this, to be a what. He is a musician. She is a dancer. They are knowledgeable human beings made up of organs with training to become fully what they were potentially. Now, how is it that they moved from that embryo to that fully formed musician or dancer? How is it that that little shrew in the dinosaur-ridden marsh, after the extinction of the dinosaurs, became a hippo, a pig, a cow, and a primate? This is the big question of evolutionary science. What is the relationship between the genome and the phenome? How is it that that little human being with infinite untold potentiality becomes that dancer? Totally incapable of philosophy, no doubt, but fully formed as a dancer. Whereas her sibling becomes a philosopher. What is this amazing relationship between form and matter, between potentiality and actuality? How does that matter in the genes of the shrew become the matter in the genes of the hippo and the dolphin, when the shrew decides to go back into the water and the feet recede and become pseudo feet and the dolphin becomes a talker in the sea, because the dolphin has those mammal genes but the human beings become the real talkers. How is it that all of this matter becomes all of these forms? Well, Aristotle tells us that it's because the soul is already what the matter has to become. And it's already there in the material form. We have now given an answer to the question, what is soul? An answer which applies to it in its full extent. It is substance in the sense which corresponds to the definitive formula of a thing's essence. That means that it is the essential whatness of a body of the character just assigned. So I have my De Anima here all marked up. I'm going to jump around a little bit in this text and give you some of Aristotle's other definitions. It has been discovered by philologists that Aristotle's lectures are sort of like mine. They don't follow systematically from one to the other, but each time he gives a lecture, he says more or less the same thing from another standpoint. It's the way Sri Aurobindo wrote The Life Divine also. They're not very systematic chapters, but each one is a visioning of the same thing, and it's formulated in a slightly different way with a different emphasis than it was formulated the last time. So Aristotle's lectures are like that. And so when you read his book called The Physics or the book called The Metaphysics, don't expect to find something very much different from one chapter to the next. So what philosophers have decided to do is focus on the main one or two lectures that seem to best express the idea in that book. And I've decided that that's the best way to read Sri Aurobindo as well. You can focus on one or two or three chapters of The Life Divine that are, for you, are the best expression of the philosophy, and you can just stay with those for years. It's fine. It takes years to understand them, let me tell you.
So Aristotle, he was more lecturing, he was not writing.
He was lecturing and his students were recording the lectures. So I'm going to go first I have to reduce this a bit to see if they have that's too bad. They haven't marked the paragraphs. Okay, I wanted to read this paragraph. We must not understand by that which is potentially capable of living what has lost the soul it had, or the form that it had, but only what still retains it. No, that's not the one I wanted, sorry. This is going to be difficult. 413a. Okay, I think that's more or less. Yeah. Do what?
No, on the page, clean. Now the rose.
But only, okay, we must not understand potentially capable of living something which has lost its soul or its form, but only what still retains it. But seeds and fruits are bodies which possess the qualification potentially capable of living. The seed is there in the ground. It's still potentially capable of becoming a tree. Consequently, while waking is actuality, in a sense corresponding to the cutting and the seeing. That means that the eye is capable of seeing. It's potentially a seeing organ. And an axe is potentially a cutting instrument. So the soul is in them, unless the eye is knocked out of the head and rotting on the ground, then it's no longer capable of seeing, even though it's still an eye in some sense. Pardon me for being so graphic. Okay. The soul is actuality in the sense corresponding to the power of sight and the power in the tool. So the eyeball is just an organ, but when it functions as seeing, when it is seeing, then it is really fulfilling its potentiality. The soul of the eye, the being of the eye, is sight. The eye is only a tool. So all of the organs of the body are for the purpose for which the human being is intended, the intelligent, organizing, performing human being. The organs that make up that are not the soul, they are the matter. The body corresponds to what exists in potentiality, as the pupil plus the power of sight constitutes the eye. That's A and B in one thing. The potential and the form in the body make the human being, the structure or organ working as seeing in the body is the composite, holomorphe, matter and form making the living thing. So the soul plus the body constitutes the animal. That's how you've always thought of it, isn't it? You never thought that the skin or the foot was the animal, did you?
And then he speaks about soul that's psyche, you know, different.
Suke.
Suke.
Yes, that's the soul. It's the actuality for which the organism is intended. We resume our inquiry from a fresh starting point by calling attention to the fact that what has soul in it differs from what has not, in that the former displays life. Now, this word, life, has more than one sense, and provided any one alone of these is found in a thing, we say that that thing is living. Living, that is, may mean thinking, or perception, or local movement and rest, or movement in the sense of nutrition, decay, and growth. So he goes on to define different levels of life that are mostly alive because they nutrify themselves and they decay and they grow. Another level of life, which is moving life, in the sense of the ability to move from one place or another to get its nutrition and to reproduce itself, animals. And the third level is those forms of life which think and perceive. Animals do that perceiving part, but not much of the thinking part. So he has described the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the human in right there in that sentence. Each of these has soul. The purpose is to define soul. He says we can think of soul in three ways. Soul is that which brings about the nutritive processes in plants. It is that which brings about movement for the sake of nutritive processes in animals. And it is that which brings about movement and nutritive processes for the sake of thinking in higher animals. It is that which makes perception possible. I mean, you could have eyes and not perceive, presumably. Shrews do. They're blind. But they move, and they eat, and they reproduce. But human beings and cats and dogs normally see with their eyes. The senses, according to Aristotle, are created by the soul so that it can perceive. The soul precedes the sense organs. It brings about nutritive processes in plants. It brings about nutritive processes in animals plus perception. And it brings about in human beings and higher animals nutritive processes, movement, and perception for the sake of thinking, knowing, understanding. The soul, according to Aristotle, is what does all of that. So we find in the human cycle, Sri Aurobindo's description that I brought forth in the course on developmental psychology, where he says that the soul puts itself forth as the will in the physical, it puts itself forth as the will in the vital, and it puts itself forth as the will in the mental, and after all of these sheaths are well developed enough, the mental is able to abdicate and find the original will, which is the will to be, the pure innermost will to be, behind the physical and the vital and the mental forces and forms, there is an essential will to be, the psychic being itself. But in its evolution, it puts forth first the physical and the vital and the mental, and it lives in, as Savitri, the book, tells us in canto after canto after canto, this original being that comes into existence and follows nature through all of her development until finally at the end, on the heights of evolution, it rediscovers its essential self nature and its connection with the supraconscious planes, and it puts that essential self nature, pure being, surrender, transparency, and luminosity in contact with the higher, the other hemisphere, and those powers begin to descend in mind and life and body with that psychic being as the immovable will to be divine. Not just the will to be anymore, but the will to be divine. Don't ask any questions, please. So, I just jumped past Sheldrake to Sri Aurobindo. But the big mystery that all of the biologists and all of the philosophers, Bergson and Sri Aurobindo and Whitehead and everyone, the big mystery that they're trying to solve is not how the structure of everything works, but what's driving it forward. Nature shows us how everything works. But when we do the Buddhistic reduction and we put aside all of our so-called understandings of things, we perceive nature as a whole, being, working in all the myriad ways that she works. But we don't know, normally, what is driving each thing to evolve. So Aristotle is working on this problem, and he tells us that it is the essential form or self of the thing which is there all the time, driving it to develop into what it potentially is. This is Aristotle's grasp and explanation of how nature works.
Aristotle inherited this concept of potentiality and actuality from Plato. It is like in the air and the natural world, it is the same duality. Which he developed further.
So I'm going to try to move here to chapter 4 and wind up this introduction to Aristotle and finish it next time along with Sheldrake. It is necessary for the student of these forms of soul, first these forms which we just iterated, nutritive, motive, and perceptive, and thinking forms of soul, first to find a definition of each, expressive of what it is. Now, this is the human being in a nutshell. This is what prevents us from realizing the truth. Because it is necessary for us first to find a definition of each thing expressive of what it is. And then we can say we understand it. And then to investigate its derivative properties. That's science and philosophy, right there, in a nutshell. The beginning and the end of the evolution of mind. Right there. But if we are to express what each is, namely, what the thinking power is, or the perceptive, or the nutritive, okay? Philosophy, psychology, biology, physics. We must go farther back and first give an account of thinking or perceiving. For in the order of investigation, the question of what an agent does precedes the question, what enables it to do what it does? What enables the perceptive organs to perceive? What enables the mind to think? What enables the nutritive powers to digest food and procreate in a systematic, organized way? We just know that that's what they do. And we describe them. We name them. But what enables them to do those things? Well, the answer, to get down to the basic reality here, Aristotle's not trying to fool us. He's just trying to show us what it's all about. The soul is the cause or source of the living body. The terms cause and source have many senses. But the soul is the cause of its body alike in all three senses which we explicitly recognize. It is A, the source or origin of movement. It is B, the end for which we move. And it is C, the essence of the whole process. That it is the last, the essence, is clear, for in everything the essence is identical with the ground of its being. So when we say we know what something is and we believe that it is that, it is a ficus tree. It does put down roots and expand over a large area, and it does function like a tree in every respect, except that it is a unique one. It puts down roots from every branch. It's a banyan tree. That's all we really need to say. That is its essence. It is not an acacia, and it is not a palm, and it is not a rose or a rose bush. It is a banyan, and it gets to be that because that is its essential nature, and it has evolved to be that. And normally when we know that, we are satisfied. And we forget about what it really is. We don't care what it really is. We're happy with our understanding of what it is, our frame. And we think we know what it really is when we have identified its essence. And this wonderful philosophy of Aristotle, which has allowed human beings to know everything that they know, is now the source of the problem. Because that banyan tree is not essentially what we define it to be. And knowledge is not the end for which it exists. It is manifest that the soul is also the final cause of its body. For nature, like mind, always does whatever it does for the sake of something. So every species and every individual of every species does what it does for the sake of surviving. And some do what they do for the sake of not only surviving themselves, but surviving other organisms, so that all of nature survives. And human beings do what they do for the sake of healing and creating beauty and knowledge and cultivating fields and celebrating their existence in the universe. Nature at every level does what she does for a purpose. And the neo-Darwinians, brilliant scientists that they are, say this all the time. But then they ask the question, how on earth does nature manage to find ways that are so perfect for achieving her purposes? Is it Darwinian? Is it Lamarckian? Is it Sheldrakean? What is the process that allows nature to do what she does so exquisitely in every little niche of the evolutionary movement? Aristotle had the answer right from the beginning. Then the metaphysician comes along and says, well, so the soul is the driving force, and the soul is the end product and the organizing principle and the essence. How did that happen to be the case? How is it that nature carries the soul? Prakriti carries Purusha. How does that work? How is this spiritual entity carried by this natural process? Do we know, just because we read it in Canto 3 of Book 1 of Savitri? Are we actively engaged in the dynamic understanding of how the soul drives nature to become what she becomes? Or is this just an abstract notion, a concept? If it was not just a concept, then we would know how the soul does that. But as long as it's just a concept, we don't know. It's a theory. It's a concept. Sri Aurobindo says that we can know directly. Gnostic consciousness is chit shakti, consciousness force at work in everything, being what it is. And that consciousness, the next stage of the evolution of consciousness, is that way of being. Knowing energetically the truth of everything, the relationship between soul and matter. The identity. Because that's the secret. It's an identity. But as long as we're analyzing form and matter, We don't perceive the identity. And we, and Sheldrake, wonderful genius that he is, has gone completely down this road of trying to prove the relationship by abstractions. Abstractions upon abstractions upon abstractions don't take us to that knowing. It requires a transformation of consciousness by a higher power that unifies being and knowing. No barriers, no separation, no more ego centrality. And it's hard to do. It requires breaking through some very ancient, well-established habits called perception and knowing. So actually, I would like to just show you one thing that Sri Aurobindo said to justify what I just said. This is short, very short passage. I can never finally get to page 8. This was the first study that I did in this philosophy of evolution. Sri Aurobindo said, if modern materialism were simply an unintelligent acquiescence in the material life, the advance might be indefinitely delayed. But since its very soul is the search for knowledge, it will be unable to cry a halt, materialism, as it reaches the barriers of sense knowledge. That's what I was just trying to point to, the barriers of sense knowledge, what we know through our senses, and of the reasoning from sense knowledge. When the materialistic search for knowledge reaches the barrier and knows that sense knowledge and reasoning from sense knowledge is limited, absolutely, its very rush will carry it beyond. And the rapidity and sureness with which it has embraced the visible universe is only an earnest in the conquest of what lies beyond once the stride is taken that crosses the barrier. This is my summation. The stride that Sri Aurobindo hints at here, and which he refers to in the same context as being attainable by a supreme effort of consciousness, but also as escaping the grasp of our thought and speech, instruments which proceed always by the sense of difference and express by the way of definition, to cross beyond that barrier of mental consciousness implies another methodology than the one normally employed by science, which is always based on observation of the external world, on sense knowledge, and on reasoning from that knowledge, even if it is sometimes accompanied by a more global phenomenon of inspired seeing. The proposed methodology entails a process often referred to by Sri Aurobindo as a transformation of consciousness. So we started this course with the description of the citta, manas, and buddhi, where Sri Aurobindo led us to what that means, where that barrier lies, and what has to be done to break it, to cross through it. And that, he says, will be a point that is reached by materialism as well as by psychology. Spiritual psychology. Both will reach that barrier and cross beyond it at some point. Because the soul has in mind something more than scientific and philosophical understanding of existence. So Aristotle's not so bad. You think?
It has to constantly arch out over Shantra Krishna in the mental things.
Yeah. Well, that's my role. I'm not going to ask anybody to read Aristotle, but I love reading Aristotle myself. And I've read the metaphysics and the physics in Greek also.